Hello and welcome to WBAA's Off the Field with Morgan Burke. Every other week we chat with Purdue's athletics director about some of the more notable goings-on in sports and around the university. If you've got a question, you can always email that to news@wbaa.org, or you can tweet it at WBAA News on Twitter. We should note that we're taping the show a little bit late this morning, as we normally do, because you're just back from Minnesota. Quite a game last evening.
Well, the game was amazing. People can read about the storyline and the website of the newspaper, but I was just astounded last night. I walked into the arena. We have one kid that's got bruised ribs. One kid is out for the game. Another kid's out for the game. One's throwing up in a trash can. It was just an astounding game by about eight young women who just refused to lose. And I mean, to anybody who's trying to look for why do you do college athletics, it was an amazing experience to watch those young women. They were way up, came into overtime, had to fight their way back, made a shot with 3 seconds to go. The young lady who made the shot is the one who had been sick all day and severely dehydrated, but she just wasn't going to quit. So it's a neat story, and although it was a late night, we got home at 2 o'clock.
I had heard that was going to happen, and I have to say I've been watching Whitney Bayes throughout the entire season, and I don't know what goes through the minds of somebody who might draft somebody in the WNBA draft, but by golly, if she doesn't look like somebody who could be a pro.
Well, she certainly has the skill set, and I think she'll get that opportunity. But this is a totally retooled team. You lost two great guards in Courtney Moses and K.K. Hauser. You had to replace them with Ashley Morsetti and April Wilson. They're doing a great job, just starting to hit their stride. So Sunday against Ohio State will be, another good test for them. But I like where that team's heading right now.
I wanted to get back to you on a couple of things that I've chatted about with other people since you and I last spoke. Had an opportunity to sit down with President Daniels last week on our monthly conversation with him and broached him the subject of, there needs to be money raised to renovate Ross-Ade Stadium. How are we going to do that? And he said, I will go out there and I will help Morgan raise money from loyal alumni to try to do that, but I'm not sure about giving money from the trustees to that. Does that help you significantly?
Absolutely. That's the way we've done every project. That's no different. I would never, ever, ever expect the trustees to give us a handout. Every project we've done over the last 20 years has been a combination of gift funds and internally generated funds. So, Mitch's willingness to help us with people who want to engage in this kind of philanthropy is perfect. That's all we've ever asked. I remind people when I first came to the university, I was told that I was on an island. That island had no bridges to the mainland. And the symbolism was you had to pay your own freight. You had to build your own buildings and maintain them and the like. And we've done that. And what I've gotten from President Bering and President Jiskie and President Cordova is the same thing I know I will get from Mitch, and that is a willingness to zero in on people who would have an affinity and interest to support this activity at Purdue. People who give money to athletics give money to other places in the university. I think sometimes people who are kind of new to the philanthropy game feel that it's a zero-sum game. If athletics gets the gift, it's not going anywhere else. That's a very, very false myth. And I think if you talk to people who've been involved in philanthropy, and certainly I'm one of them, I can tell you some of our best donors are also major donors in other colleges and other causes in the university. So I like to think of people who – if they have the interest in Purdue, they'll find the areas they want to be, whether it's WBAA or athletics or the residence halls or student government, whatever the case may be, in addition to their colleges. So Mitch's willingness to jump in is helpful, and we had a good meeting with the architects last week. Maybe on one of our shows down the road we can talk a bit more about how that whole process is unfolding.
You had said on previous shows that you were kind of in the process of trying to choose an architectural firm. Is that still where you are in the process?
Yeah, now we're actually a little further ahead. We've gone from six firms down to four, and those four then came in on January 14th for a visit. We now are in the process of working with the right people on campus to kind of assimilate which one of those four. They're all very, very good. And it's very clear that we've got a master plan, a concept that's going to evolve. It's not just the south end zone. I think what we're going to do is take a look, like we did with the Mackey Complex, which was made up of five or six projects from softball to Mackey to the Breeze Academic Center. We're going to look at what we have to do to support the investment in football to get us back where we want to be. our strategic plan, which we announced last week, Plan 2020, will only be successful. And by successful, I mean our ability to stay self-supporting and compete at the highest level if football's successful. And we've talked on this show about, you know, the hole we've got right now in attendance and some of the angst that exists within the fan base. We got to turn that. And facilities aren't the only answer, but they're a piece of it. And we'll be talking more about specific plans for football that are embedded in Plan 2020 in the weeks ahead.
You mentioned the Breeze Academic Center, and this is something I haven't asked you about regarding Ross-Ade, which is you, of course, have had a football program that sent a great many people to the NFL, and these people are, in many cases, very well compensated. Is it possible you could go back to particularly the more successful alums, the Drew Breeses, the Ryan Kerrigans of the world, and say, look, I see you have this really nice life, you have this really nice contract, and your football stadium at your alma mater could use some help. Could you do it and make it kind of a public relations thing around, hey, the football players have really made this happen?
That's really what's happened with Drew's gift and Brian Cardinal with Cardinal Courts, indoor practice facility. I wouldn't sell it quite like that. I think what you have to do is engage people on the plan. As I said, our plan will involve about five or six different factors. I would hope that we'd be able to get a focus group of former football players, some as part of our Football Leadership Council, which will be back in April. Those are former alums from all generations who played football, as well as a select group of NFL players. Because I'd like them to sit with Coach Hazel and I and talk, let Daryl talk about what he's doing to rebuild the program, get their input and reactions, let them be a kind of a critical voice, if you will, since they're inside the family and they can ask tough questions. They've seen what it takes to be champions. And it'll also give us an opportunity to share some of the brick-and-mortar concepts. But, yes, they're like any Purdue alum. If they have an interest and an affinity for a particular area, we'd be remiss if we didn't put the opportunity out in front of them, and we will.
This is WBAA's Off the Field with Morgan Burke. You can send us questions. news@wbaa.org is our email address. You can also tweet questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, on our show a couple weeks ago, we talked about the upcoming meetings that were to be happening between representatives of the so-called Power Five conferences at the NCAA's annual meeting. Some of those have happened, and I wanted to get your reactions to some of the things that did happen. There was this near unanimous vote on allowing universities to pay the full freight of student athlete costs. And because this had come out of the discussion of saying, well, full tuition, full room and board really isn't happening and isn't allowed to happen in a lot of cases. Right. Just one dissenting vote. And I think a lot of people recognized that this was a vote that was going to happen. I'm not sure everyone thought it was going to be as near unanimous as it was. How does it affect Purdue? How does it affect your bottom line?
Well, it'll be about $1 million a year, and we'll come up with that money within athletics to do it. As I pointed out on this show before, the definition of grant and aid under the NCAA bylaws covers three items: tuition and fees, room and board, and books. And it does not cover what the financial aid people would refer to as transportation, as to and from for holidays and the like, and miscellaneous expenses. So those are the two items that you're allowed now to cover. The financial aid people will control what that amount is. They have a certain process that's driven by federal regulations in terms of how they do that for all students. That makes us a little leery because there are some appeal processes within that mechanism for all students that we hope are managed appropriately, and I know they will be on this campus. But I remind the listeners that this is not breaking new ground. For those who were around in the 60s, there was a miscellaneous expense money that student athletes were given. That time is $15 a month. The equivalent value of that today is about $2,000 a year. So all we've really done is reinstated and recognized we're going to try to cover the full cost of attendance for these young men and women. And to those who are on full scholarship, as I pointed out, I think on this show, if not, I'll reiterate, it's worth mentioning. The value of a full out-of-state scholarship, if you include just the services that a student athlete taps daily, my trainer, my sports medicine staff, my SID, my academic advisor, the value is over $250,000, and they leave debt-free. Not a bad deal. When people talk about, are the kids being exploited, we just are not doing a very good job of getting the whole story out there and saying, if your son or daughter could come debt-free, get a full out-of-state scholarship, have up to 5 years to complete their scholarship, you know, get a world-class education in a university they may or may not get admitted to solely on the basis of their academic requirements? Are they being disadvantaged? It's a debatable point, but one that I'd come down on saying, no, they're not.
You mentioned the financial aid people fitting into this discussion, and there have been a great many stories at this university and dozens of others, hundreds of others, about student athletes who come from disadvantaged backgrounds mm-hmm. and become star athletes and go on to great things. And I wonder if this helps get those people a little bit further ahead of the curve, because now you can really say, look, we understand that even these extra costs that you were going to have to pay in the past would have been hard for you. Now we can help you out with those too, even if you're coming from far away to Purdue.
Well, I don't worry so much about that group, and that may sound funny, but that group right now is eligible for federal Pell Grant money. And if mom and dad don't have the expected family contribution or they're down at a certain point, they can qualify for up to $5,600 a year in cash. So they're okay. It's the moms and dads that are both working. You know, maybe combined they're making $70,000-$80,000 a year. Those are the people who, you know, it looks on the tax form like they had should be able to contribute a little bit to their son or daughter's education. But, boy, that doesn't leave much for anything else. So it's the middle-class kid, if I can use that term, that is really getting shortchanged. The kid who's got financial need, federal public policy is recognizing that today. Now, the irony of this whole thing could be, you know, the feds are all looking for money too, right? They've got a deficit. Yeah, I'm waiting to see what kind of reaction they have when all of a sudden somebody's Pell Grant eligible now gets an additional gap payment, if you will, to cover the cost of attendance. Are they going to offset the Pell Grant? So we're going to see how that all plays out. And I've talked to some of the financial aid people on this campus and elsewhere, and that'll be an interesting chess game, because I just don't think there are people in Washington today who are trying to figure out what to do with tight resources that are going to say that a student athlete who's got financial need should get $5,600, and if they're out of region member of the student body, they might qualify for $3,000 or $4,000 worth of gap payments. $9,600 or some amount like that to a college student is like being a millionaire. And I worry about how they're going to spend it. We're going to work real hard on this campus to see if we have the capability to treat the payment on to rather than making it one check a year or one check a semester, I'd prefer to do it once a month. I think it helps with budgeting and avoid some of the issues that can happen if all of a sudden you see that big chunk and you think it's going to last a long time.
Well, it strikes me as an opportunity to have conversations with student athletes about fiscal responsibility
yes.
and some of those other things that are tough to learn in college.
Yeah, and we do that, but I like to give them a little extra helping hand by taking away the temptation to spend it all at once.
This is WBAA's Off the Field with Morgan Burke. We're glad you're with us. We're talking about the meetings that have gone on among the so-called Power Five conferences, representing some new autonomy for some of those schools. Another proposal that narrowly passed was one actually allowing schools to take away scholarships based on performance on the field by some athletes. And there were a number of student athletes who stepped up and said, we're really not sure about this one. The vote still passed, but by a close margin. Where do you come down on that?
Well, let's go back and get the facts straight on that one. I'm not sure you read it quite right. What it said is that right now, at the end of a term, somebody could have their aid pulled for athletic reasons. You remember, we used to be on a year-to-year scholarship basis. That year-to-year was waived. We can go out to 4 years. What they were doing here was really trying to make sure that during the at the end of the term of the scholarship, you couldn't pull the aid for athletic reasons. We've never done that at Purdue. And there's always an appellate review body here on campus and every campus with no athletic representation that's chaired by the financial aid people and some faculty where we got to go and make our case. Why'd you do what you did? Now, at the same time, I came out pretty aggressively in a piece in the Journal Courier and said, this does not mean we're going to give somebody an entitlement program. If they come in, a student athlete comes in, and they're good enough and been awarded a scholarship, we expect, just like any other athlete, they're going to give their full performance. If they become a cancer in the locker room, become negative, slow the progress of their team down, don't live up to their academic responsibilities, they're gone. And we've probably been a little bit more lax on that in the past, But I think now that you're giving this guarantee that there's got to be an accountability. Part of college and part of college athletics is about teaching people discipline and accountability. Now, the fact that we can't make the decision unilaterally is spot on. You want to have checks and balances in the system. And you're not. We're not going to take an aid from a young person without notice and without having a story that you, if you were on the tribunal, could say, yes, I agree with that. So I don't. I think the checks and balances were here at Purdue, but I don't think they were at other places. So I think this way we're saying, look, if a kid comes in, busts their tail, does everything they can do to be a good teammate, be a good student, be good in the community, but maybe they just don't get any better athletically, we're not going to pull their aid. And we never have at Purdue.
So it makes me think of a couple of possible scenarios where you could have somebody who it seems unlikely that somebody who, for instance, gets injured would have their scholarship pulled as long as they're trying to get back to being in playing shape. But the other scenario I can think of, again, seems unlikely, but I'm curious about your thoughts, is you give a scholarship to what you think is a really talented young linebacker on the football team, and the linebacker just, you know, doesn't perform well on the field, no sacks, only a couple of tackles here and there. I think there were some people who worried, hey, I didn't live up to my expectations on the field, and therefore the school might pull the scholarship, even if I'm trying.
Right.
Seems unlikely, but...
I think in past days that did happen. I think that's one of the impetuses for passing this kind of legislation. And, you know, again, if a young person is hurt medically and are unable to ever come back, they get what they call as a medical redshirt, and they're carried on whatever scholarship level they're at through the balance of their college career. So those kids are taken care of. It's the youngster who comes in and tries hard, who doesn't produce at the highest level, they could be disadvantaged. And I think that as long as, and I've told our coaches, the worst thing you can do to an administrator like me is to have a parent come in and say, I had no notice. So you got to tell them the hard stuff along the way. If somebody's giving you a hard time in the locker room, they're mouthy, they're doing just the minimum. Got to be willing to have those hard conversations with both the student athlete and the parent, so that when you get to the terminal point, you can say, look, we may agree to disagree, but don't tell me this is the first time you've heard of this, and we've talked about ways in which your son or daughter could put themselves in good standing.
So sort of an incremental performance.
Yeah, it's you know, they're not employees, but the concept of progressive action is appropriate. So, again, we're pretty watchful. First of all, I always tell a coach, you have control of your roster. My office has control of whether they get grant and aid. So we have a check and balance even within athletics. And then, as I said, if the coach and I or one of my administrators agree that a scholarship should be pulled, and we've done some of that, not very much, then we got to be able to have a case to go before this tribunal if the matter's appealed. And our batting record's pretty good because I don't think we act indiscriminately.
I saw a quote from Kansas State University's president in one of the publications that covered the meetings, and he said, and I'm quoting now, the $120 million programs are going to have a different perspective than the $50 million programs. I don't know that we've seen that yet, but do you think there's weight to what he's saying?
Absolutely. I liken this autonomy process, if I can make an analogy, and it's not a perfect analogy, but it's one I think the listeners can relate to. Right now, the current NCAA process is like trying to get something through the House of Representatives. I mean, there are hundreds of representatives, right? 376 or whatever the number is. Think of autonomy as being more like the Senate. You've got a smaller group. It can be more focused debate among people of comparable but certainly not equal resources.
Advise and consent.
Yeah, and there'll be plenty of dispute. And I think the absolute misnomer in this whole thing is that it's all about adding more benefits. I think there's some things that we need to do to take a good hard look at whether we're exploiting freshmen, student-athletes in the sport of football and men's basketball. Now, what do I mean by exploiting? I think you're taking kids into this system and asking them to compete, go to school, big stage, all that when they're 18 years of age. Then you look at if things aren't going quite right, does that lead to some form of aberrant behavior on the campus or some kind of substance abuse issue? You know, if we're going to offer multi-year scholarships, maybe we ought to look real hard at those two sports and say, do they need a year of readiness? Now, why those two sports? Number one, they're the ones on the biggest stage. They're most closely attuned to the professional ranks, where it does look like we're a minor league, which I find very distasteful. That's not what we should be all about. If a kid can get to the professional ranks, so be it. That's great. But that's not what we're all about.
So it sounds a little like you're talking about going back to the way it used to be, where freshmen don't play varsity sports.
Well, these two sports. Now, let me take it a step further. One is because you want to create more of a demarcation line with the professional model. But the second thing is, if you look at the academic data nationally, this cohort of men's basketball and football is down here, and everybody else is up here. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't kids that are football and basketball players who aren't bright as heck and you could go right away and go in 4 years and be done.
Just so I can convey to the listeners what you just sort of showed me with your hands, you're saying that football and basketball players academically are a rung below the rest of the sports.
Yes, as a cohort, not as an individual. And I think that if you look at their graduation rates, they're also below the students. So what it does to me, and I look at the exploitation, the pressure on, if you take a kid here and they come into Purdue and they're admissible, but they're competing against kids that might have 600-700 on their math scores, SATs. They get in that same math class, and all of a sudden they're saying, "Wow, you know, that's some of that stuff I don't understand." So you're already getting into kind of a negative mode. Then you're trying to compete as a freshman. Then you got the media putting a mic in front of you. You got Twitter doing this to you. It's a lot for an 18-year-old. So I think the circumstances have changed, and I think in those two sports we ought to have a debate. I know that President Daniels and our coaches on this campus support that debate. I would hope it would evolve this spring. I don't know whether it'll carry, but that to me would show a real reinforcement of the collegiate model. You don't have to do it in every sport. Every sport's not in the same situation, but these two cohorts, particularly because of the environment these kids are coming out of, whether it be AAU basketball or 7-7 football, there's a mentality, unfortunately, that pervades the cohort that suggests entitlement. And when they leave college, the employer is not going to entitle them to anything. So I think it is a debate worthy to have. So when you talk about autonomy, there are going to be topics like that. Now, whether they get through, but I hope they get the public debate and the discussion that they deserve.
So one of the other things that was discussed at this meeting was creating a better balance for student athletes between being a student and being an athlete, and trying to determine what is the appropriate amount of time that someone can actually spend in their athletic training so that they are still allowed to go to class and do all those sorts of things. And when President Daniels was on our program last week, and he's a big sports fan, he pointed out to me that the Ohio State quarterback, when being interviewed before the national championship football game, had said, "Well, we don't go to school to be students. We go to school to play football." Right. And he said he worried about that, and I know you worry about that happening. So it would seem like it's a good discussion to have, to talk about how much time are you spending on the field and how much are you spending in the classroom.
Yeah, and I think that needs to be done sport by sport. You know, my suggestion as we get into that debate would be that you get some of the experienced coaches, experienced administrators, and experienced sports physiologists. A track athlete's training cycle versus a football training cycle could be markedly different. There's three phases to each program. When you think about it, there's a preparation phase, there's a competition phase, and there's a recovery phase. I don't care whether you're a football player or a swimmer. And so what we ought to do is get the experts to say, what's the right preparation phase? What do we need to do in competition? And what's the right recovery phase? And that may lead to differential. In some sports, it might be 15 hours a week. Some sports, it might be 25 hours a week. A distance runner is not going to be a world-class athlete on 20 hours a week. They just won't. And they'll do it anyway. So what you don't want to do is, if a kid is really driven to make the Olympics or make the pros, and what you do is you force them to train on their route on their own or go to a third party when you have coaches, that's not what you want to do. So what you want to do is build the case with the people who have a stake in it, both student athletes, coaches, and administrators and sports physiologists. What's the right training cycle? Because then you're going to optimize their ability, and that's what you should be trying to do. So that's not going to be easy to do, but it's not beyond the realm, and it's the proper way to do it, in my opinion.
Do you think doctors have had any sort of stake in these discussions or enough of a stake in these discussions heretofore?
Well, I think, I do. But doctors are oftentimes on the back end. they're on the fixing them up. I want to get the sports physiologists. So it's the Dwayne Carlisles of the world who are involved in sports performance or kinesiology, as you like to call it, that are really trying to say to be a football student athlete, to be a swimmer, to be a diver, what do we need to do to make that bring that young person to the best of their ability? And there are training cycles. I know as a former swimmer, there were things that we did each part of the year to prepare ourselves for peak competition. Every sport's a little different, so you got to look at it. But I can tell you, Darrell Hazel has very, very rarely used the 20 hours a week. Now, at the same time, does that mean that Danny Etling or Austin Appleby or David Blau, who are the three quarterbacks, don't come over after they've done their study and look at film? I mean, we don't deny a kid the opportunity to go into a biology lab if they're a talented student, do we? We let them go in. But I don't want that veiled pressure. That's the hard part, where you say it's voluntary, but then you wink. That's the stuff that bothers me. And I think we just need to get on solid footing physiologically as to what's the right thing to do. Dave Shondell, who's a world-class volleyball coach, blessed to have him here at Purdue. He and I have talked that, these kids that start in the age group volleyball when they're 8, 9, 10 years old, getting travel, by the time they get here, there's only so many jumps left in their knees. So he's found himself really backing off. But he said, sometimes I feel like the cook who's kind of tinkering with the ingredients rather than systematically looking what I need to do to improve the product. Now, those are my words. Dave will probably shoot me when I get back to the office. But I think that's the message I come away with is we need to put some more science. And there's plenty of science out there. Get the United States Olympic Committee, and they have a high-performance center. Get some of the NFL and NBA who have invested a lot in high-performance. Get the right experts in a room. Build the right model, and you'll figure out how many hours they should spend.
So real quick, in just our last 30 mm-hmm. seconds, it sounds like what you're saying is be careful about each individual sport and be careful about being too unilateral in your approach.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, as always, we've got more questions and more to talk about, but we'd love to have your questions for Morgan Burke for our next show. You can always email those to news@wbaa.org. You can tweet your questions anytime at WBAA News on Twitter. And hey, use those to give us feedback about the show. We're always trying to make the show better. And if there's a topic you want to hear about, we'd love to have it. This has been WBAA's Off the Field with Morgan Burke. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.